Welcome to Life Off Screen with Dan and Peggy Ruppel. Thank you for joining us. If you're enjoying this podcast, do us a favor and subscribe to the show and give us a rating. Life Off Screen is produced by Master Media International. And to find out more about Master Media or the Life Off Screen podcast, visit us at lifeoffscreen.com. And now, here's Dan and Peggy.
Hello and welcome to Life Off Screen. I'm Dan Ruppel. I'm here with my wife, Peggy. And you may have noticed good news, bad news. The good news is we got a new camera. Yeah. Wow, we're not as blurry as we used to be. But the bad news is we got a new camera. You could really see us. There's no filters now. You can see my sunburn and you can see our ears. So tell them about the show today.
We have Brian and Patty Bird with us, and you're going to love them. Brian is a 30-year vet, film and television, and he has been at this a long time, and his creds are remarkable. His earliest one you'll probably remember from was Touched by an Angel. But since then, he has probably done 10 films, six or seven series television shows, on and on. So yeah. Tell him a little bit more.
He co-founded with Michael Landon Jr., Believe Pictures, and they did Heart of a Man, which is a great film. We're going to mention it in the interview. But also Case for Christ, Captive with David Oyelowo. But now he's really struck some pay dirt. A wonderful show on the Hallmark Channel called When Calls the Heart. And it has taken, they're ready to launch, their eighth season? Mm-hmm. Their eighth season. It's a huge hit. That's an understatement. It is the most popular show on the Hallmark Channel, but it's also, I believe, the most popular scripted show on Sunday night television.
Remarkable.
And that's saying an awful lot.
And you'll meet Patty, his wife, and you want to talk about a champion. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone needs that, right? But in the industry of film and television, to have Brian and Patty work together the way they do, it has made all the difference. So she is really a champion in life to them and their five children. You'll hear more about their remarkable story with their kids, too.
So we hope you enjoy our conversation. Let's just jump right in. Welcome, Brian and Patty.
Hey, welcome.
Thrilled to be with you guys. Great to see you.
Great to see you.
Yes,
and
yes.
As we were talking before the show, we used to be neighbors.
Yes.
You used to live just a couple blocks from here. And I remember, because Brian, you and I would run into each other at Starbucks quite often. And one time I was in Starbucks and I said, hey, what's going on? You said, well, I'm going to Colorado Springs. And I said, oh, have a good trip. And you said, no, I'm moving to Colorado Springs. And I said, when? I thought you were going to say 3 months from now. And you said, Saturday.
Wow.
So you're talking to us from Colorado.
We are. We've been here about 5 years now. And we miss you guys there in Orange County. But we love where we live. So
yes.
Yeah.
Coming from Colorado for 3 years, Arvada, not terribly far from you, but pretty stinking beautiful.
Oh, yes. Oh,
to have the seasons. And so when did you first want to be a writer? I'm just curious, Brian, about when that bug bit you, and were there other writing aspirations or other aspirations for other careers?
My mom kept a picture that I had made when I was probably seven or 8 years old. And it said, and I had a little, it was like a picture of TV cameras. And then
I had it framed, but it's faded so much.
Yeah.
Now.
Patty found it and had it framed for my office, but it said, when I grow up, I'm going to make movies and TV shows.
Whoa.
And I was 8 years old. Now, frankly,
I think you thought you were going to be a cameraman because he drew three cameras.
Yeah.
ABC, NBC, and CBS.
Yeah. Yeah, literally, it said all those
three.
Things.
Yeah. Cameraman, maybe.
little hokey little stick pictures of TV cameras. But
Brian, it's a good thing you didn't make it today. You'd be making 100 little, or maybe 1,000 little cameras for all the networks.
All the platforms.
But, you know, it was when I was a freshman in high school that I had an English teacher in high school that held me back after class, and I thought I was in trouble. I thought I was busted for something. Mm-hmm. She said, stay after class, and the bell rang and my friends were leaving and looking back at me, you know, with faces that oh, you're busted, dude. You're in trouble.
Yeah.
So I went up to the desk and you know, wondering what happened. And she had an essay that I had written, and she held it up, and she had put an A plus on there. And she said, I want to enter this in an essay contest for you. Are you okay with that? And I thought, hey, I'm not in trouble. Sure. This is a good news, you know?
Yes.
And, but she said, then she looked me right in the eye and she said, the most important thing I want to say to you is you could do this for a living if you want to.
Wow, and what encouragement.
I was just kind of a wallflower kid. There was nothing really special about me. My parents loved me, but they didn't really know what I was good at. Mm-hmm. And, but that teacher, Mrs. Stevens in English, I remember her name. She called me out and she said, you have a skill here and mm-hmm. you need to pursue it. And all the way through high school, she dogged me, you know, she kept pushing me and
wow.
she finally got me to get on the school newspaper. She said, you need to go to journalism school when you get out of high school. And so honestly, you know, that adult champion in my life,
mm-hmm.
My parents loved me, but they didn't really spot mm-hmm. that in me. It was somebody on the outside who sort of became a champion for me and pushed
and
me.
Isn't it amazing when we're young, powerful. When someone speaks value, destiny, calls out with encouragement mm-hmm. on our gifting. I mean, it's amazing. Okay, I want to go back to when the two of you met. When, where, how did you meet and fall in love?
You want me to say?
Yeah, you can tell the story.
We basically met at church in Whittier, California. We knew each other, probably knew of each other for many years because of being in the same church. And then I was at Biola University. Well, it was Biola College then, you know, 15 minutes from our church.
And which you guys know all about, Biola.
Yes.
And I was in the college department at the church, and Brian was president of the college church
Imagine
department.
That.
So we started talking then. It was my, I think, second year in college. And we started kind of talking a little bit. And then when... Sunday afterwards, he asked me to go to Coco's. We went to Coco's, and it was actually my birthday that day. And I was like really embarrassed. I didn't tell him because kind of embarrassed that like it's my birthday and I have nothing else going on. So we went to Coco's and we sat for hours and talked. I think it was that next Sunday he was standing in the back of the church. It was super hot, you know, in August and it had to be over 100 degrees. And he's standing in the back and he had this, it looked like, well, you know, leather that looks like plastic back in the day. He had this brand new leather coat on. And I remember thinking, God, it's so hot. Why does he have that hot coat on? And it smelled so strong like leather, you know, probably chemical. But he told me that he was going to go to, what's it called?
The Red Onion, in Newport.
In Newport Beach the next right. Hey, I'm going to the Red Onion next
I'm going to happen to be there. Would you like to go? Because I'm going to be
back end way of asking for a date.
Exactly, great pickup line. Just in case you happen to be anywhere near the vicinity.
Yeah. In case you want to hang out with me, you know, maybe we could go hang out together.
Because I went back and my roommate and I were just like rolling on the bed. Hey, I'm just going to happen to be at the Red Onion by myself.
That is so funny. Here you thought you were being so smooth.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was smooth in my red leather jacket. That was brilliant.
Yeah.
Now, how long from when you first started these kind of dates till you're actually married?
A year and a half.
Yeah, we got we dated. The first time we went out was her birthday in 79, and then by December of 1980 is when we got married. So mm-hmm. December 13th.
So. Quick, just like us back in those days, we kind of knew pretty quick. One year to the day, actually. We were married.
It would be probably a month after dating. We both knew.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think maybe it was different for all of us older folk back in the day, you know, than it maybe is for some of our kids now who seem mm-hmm. to need to wait longer until they have their sort of ducks in a row. We sort of felt like you know, why not figure life out together as opposed to have it all figured out first? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we actually were slow by my parents' standards. They were engaged in a month.
Married
3 months after they met. And it wasn't because they had a bun in the oven.
right.
Well, we were a two VW family when we got married.
Yeah.
So,
but no, I want to comment on what you just said, Brian. I feel the same way as you. I was talking to a film student, and I was asking if she, you know, had a boyfriend or anything, and she says, "Oh no, I'm not dating. I'm not going to even look into that. I want to totally establish my career. Mm-hmm. I want to, you know, make sure I got a lot of money. I really have a trajectory, et cetera." And I said, "Hey, first of all, do whatever God's calling you to do. But I want to tell you, we didn't have hardly a dollar when we got married. Right. And like basically, we had two VWs and they were pretty old as it was. And I am so thankful that we figured it out and went through all those struggles early on together. I can't imagine doing it alone.
We loved each other. We loved God, and we mm-hmm. sort of had everything that was important checked off at that point.
Yes, and, us too. Early on in your career, we have a mutual friend, which is Michael Warren.
Yes.
And he kind of took you under his wing in a manner of speaking, and introduced you into a steady a sitcom writing. Correct. Yeah. So tell me about your early connections into the industry.
Well, the earliest, so that was 1989 when we first mm-hmm. met Michael and got our first opportunity to be on the writing staff of a TV show. Mm-hmm. But my real start in TV happened about 5 years earlier. Mm. And it happened because she was my best agent at the time.
Ah, Daddy.
I was working in magazine work and newspaper work at the time. And
World Vision.
And also working for World Vision and World Vision Magazine and doing journalism, which is what I went to college for. And she cornered her uncle Don, her great uncle Don Ingalls, at a family gathering. And Uncle Don was a TV and film writer and producer for years, going back to the golden age of television. He had done all the famous Western shows. He'd worked on Star Trek and Bonanza and
Virginia,
The Rifleman. You know, he went back to those early, you know, golden years. And so Patty cornered him at a family gathering and said, "Uncle Don, you should read my husband Brian's news clippings, his bylines from the magazine and newspaper work." And whether he was either guilted into it or pressured by his great niece, or just a good guy, and maybe it was a little bit of both, you know, he literally read and he got back to us and then said, "Hey, you know, you're a good writer. Have you ever thought about TV or film?" But I said to him, "I've always been a huge consumer of film and TV, but never thought of myself writing." And he said, "You should." He was writing at that time on the show Fantasy Island. And we were newly married, but he said, "If we get picked up for an 8th season, I'm going to bring you in and you can pitch some ideas to us." And he was good to his word. This was 1984 when this happened. He brought me in. I pitched to him and his boss and a couple of the other writers. I brought 4 ideas in.
Smart.
They said, "You like that one? Who's your agent?" And I said,
"Batty."
I don't know. Who's my agent?
My uncle said he's got my agent.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
He's going to have my agent.
Yeah, so he got his agent to represent me. And literally, I had my first episode of television in 1984 on the show Fantasy Island. And
I didn't know that. That's awesome.
I just said to myself, if something like Fantasy Island can go all over the world like this, then the potential for life and faith affirming kind of programming is also there. And I just prayed, because I had gotten some perspective since then. I just mm-hmm. prayed. I said, "God, if you want to put me back in this game, you open the door." Yes. And a year later was when we met Michael Warren. And then after that, everything changed, and I got on television shows, and I've been working pretty much since 1989 as a writer and a producer, you know, in television and film.
Yeah, I wanted, you mentioned faith. I want to jump up to Touched by an Angel.
Yeah.
Which is a remarkable show. The fact that it was such a hit, and here it is on network television, mm-hmm. and faith is at the core of it. Talk about that experience.
Well, yeah, the connecting point for me for Touched by an Angel was actually the Michael Warren show, The Family Man, because Martha Williamson went on to create Touched by an Angel several years later, was on the writing staff of that first television show that I was a writer on, and I got to know her there. And so Michael Warren opened, Uncle Don first opened the first doors for me, but then Michael sort of opened up another door. And
another champion in your life.
Exactly. And I think it's an important, you know, an important concept that everybody needs champions in their life, right? To speak into them, to help them, you know, point them in the right direction, but also to open doors. And, you know, the thing that Michael said to my writing partner and me at the time, John Weirich, and we were a writing team back then and still actually writing projects now together. We love each other. But Michael said to us, he said, guys, I can open the door for you. And I'm happy to do that because Gary Marshall did that for me. But he said, the point is your talent has to keep the door open.
Yes.
I can't do anything for you if your talent doesn't keep the door open. I can only open it. But he said, I'm opening it and you have to promise to keep the door open for somebody else.
I can say personally that you have been this remarkable resource to me in my career at Biola University in the film program. Brian, you rarely said no, and I know how busy you are. I know this is a value. And you would, at great distance, and you would make the trek, and you would give the students just remarkable time. I want to thank you for that. Oh, that has made a difference.
Biola meant a lot to us, obviously, because Patty went there, our oldest son, and both of our oldest sons went there, and, you know, meant a lot to us. And, you know, again, Michael Warren, and that name keeps popping up. He was the guy that pulled me into that studio task force and got me involved there at that point. So it was pretty exciting.
And I got to have Cameron with me at Sundance in a class. Yes. So Cameron, your son, and so really lovely. Yeah. But Patty, this brings me to a point to ask you, what was it like for you now, all of a sudden the demands of having a husband who's working in television, episodic TV? I mean, that's a cadence your family life has to get used to. What did that look like for you?
You know, we have five children, and I think we just kind of was our way of life, you know, and we always looked forward to hiatus. Hiatus usually came, I mean, when he was doing the Touched by an Angel or different shows, there was usually a nice little 3-month break.
Yes.
It usually worked out perfectly because it was during baseball season. So all our boys played baseball. Plus we really loved to go to the Angel games. We had season tickets for the Angels. So that all worked out really well. But yeah, I've stayed home and I don't know how we could have done it without that. I joke that our kids would be selling crack on the street corner if it wasn't.
I agree with that. Honestly, you know, it's the kind of, you know, you guys know what the film and entertainment business is like because you've been involved in it. And it's not a family friendly business, sadly. I believe that the only way for you to maintain your integrity, the only way for me personally to maintain my edge in my work was knowing I had a real life at home.
Yes. Right?
Absolutely.
And it's, you know, you're playing pretend a lot. When you're in the film and TV business, you create fictional stories and, you know, and it's a very temporary kind of business because you don't know from season to season where you're going to be. Sometimes you'll leave one show and go to another show. And, you know, I've often joked that the film and TV business is like being gypsies. You kind of wander around looking for food. And when you find some food, you camp there for a while.
Yes.
No, the food runs out. Then you got to go find more food. You know, and that's
I love that.
you know, for family working in this business, you have to consciously choose to maintain your family, to maintain your marriage, to make sure that you're investing back in your family, because it's easy to get caught up in the flash of the business or the excitement of business. And that can become a drug for you.
I agree with you. You have to kind of fight for your family time. I remember when I was supervising The Price is Right, again, a demanding job, but fortunately the schedule afforded me, the minute we stopped tape after a show, I would run down the back stairway out to my car at CBS. I'd jump in my car, and on the 101 freeway, I would change into my baseball uniform, and then I would show up at the park, and I coached my son's Little League team.
Yep.
You know, and I was able to do that, you know, the entire baseball season, but it was a high value to me.
Like the first season of our show, you know, When Calls the Heart, you know, I rented a house up in the Vancouver area, and Patty came up, and with our youngest yeah. at the time, because that she was the only one still at home, but we, you know, mm-hmm. but they were with me, you know, for several months at that
Love
time.
That. And
you kind of have to do that, because you can grow apart if you don't, you know, stay intentional about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I want to circle back in a moment to When Calls the Heart, but I remember, you know, you and I would go on occasion to Starbucks, and I remember one time, and it was when you were in, I'll just say a down season of your career, where things weren't getting traction, or you were like to the 1 yard line, and then boom, the funding fell out or whatever might have happened. And right. I remember the exact table. We were sitting outside of Starbucks, and you looked at me and you said, Dan, why are we doing this? Why are we in this business?
Why do we do this to each other?
And it was like we just kind of commiserated for a few minutes, you know. And during those hard times, and I realize in hindsight, you know, When Calls the Heart's coming. Mm-hmm. But what kind of got you through? What kept you in the game?
You know, it's a great question. I mean, literally, When Calls the Heart is the feast or famine show, to be honest with you. Because during that time when we had that meeting at Starbucks and I told you what we were going through, it was the When Calls the Heart project. We, in 2008, we were filming the movie version of When Calls the Heart mm-hmm. in Alberta, Canada, when the world fell out from under us, the sky fell.
Yes.
That was during the big economic crisis of 2008. And we happened to be in the middle of filming the movie and we had to close it down with a half finished movie. That's a first world problem for sure for a lot of folks. Mm-hmm. I understand that. But in the movie business, it's like getting a brain tumor. It's the worst thing that can happen to you because it's a mess. It's a complete mess. And so I came home from Alberta with my tail between my legs, probably, you know, weeks before I met up with you, Dan. And, you know, Patty had to my agent picked me up at the airport and took me immediately to a lawyer to figure out how to save our bacon on this thing. It was a nightmare. And then he dropped me off, and Patty picked me up.
You guys up in LA.
At a Coco's or something in the parking lot, which is.
It was a liquor store in LA.
This is so sad.
But it was after 20 years of the business or more, you know, for me, I really felt like my career was over because, you know, everything shut down, you know, for everybody, not just world, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, well, we're never going to get this fixed. And I brought in some of my posse, kind of like us meeting at Starbucks, but my guys and my small group and my brother-in-law and a couple of people on staff at Saddleback Church, my buddies. And I said, guys, I have no clue how to fix this. Yeah. And I think I'm done. I think I'm done with this business. It's always been hard, right? Dan, we know this. Yeah. It's always hard. It always feels impossible until it's not. But that was harder than I ever thought it could be. Mm. And my guys said to me, you got to take 30 days and get some perspective. Don't make any rash decisions. Hold on to what is true. And he told that to both of us. Hold on to what is true.
You've heard that.
The promises in Scripture, you got to write those down and remember those and hold on to those. The fact that your family and your friends are still here, they don't, that nothing's changed about that relationship, your family. Nothing has changed about your skills. Those are still the same as they always were.
Yeah.
But the circumstances have changed. And had I quit, which we're tempted to do several times there during that year, we would not have gone on to see that project get rebuilt 3 years later and turn into a TV show that is now going into its eighth season.
Eight seasons.
And a spinoff.
And a spinoff.
Now, When Calls the Heart, I mean, it launches on the Hallmark Network, which in those days was not a real big network. It wasn't doing great in the ratings by any stretch of the imagination. But the show is a huge hit, and I know how it grew. And, you know, eight seasons picked up. What chord do you think it struck with American audiences that they just said, like, we're not seeing anything like this?
Well, I would like to think that Michael Landon Jr. and I, my partner, you know, in addition to this partner right here, who you know, I couldn't do this without her. I'd like
the
to
first believer of Believe Films.
That's right. I'd like to think we are total geniuses in our timing and all of that. The reality is that we were just blessed enough to make a show at a time when nobody else was making it. Yeah, that's really nobody. The secret.
Yeah.
You know, since Touched by an Angel, you know, we finished that show in 2003. That's 17 years ago, right?
Yeah.
A drought.
Since that time, the entire media landscape has turned into zombies and vampires and reality shows.
Yeah. Yes.
Crystal meth dealers, mafiosos. It's all dark. It's no coincidence that my partner's dad was the guy behind Little House in the Prairie and Highway to Heaven, right?
Yes.
He made a show for that audience.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And because nobody else was doing it, that's why it's a hit. We are giving food to starving people, and they are rewarding us with that for that.
Well, your champions multiplied and multiplied and multiplied in such a way, unprecedented support.
Yep. Yes.
With the Hardys.
The Hardys. It's true. It's true. Yeah, we counted them recently. We had some people help us count them on social media.
Mm-hmm.
2.1 million people who call themselves Hardys.
Wow.
Oh.
They self-identify as Hardys. 4 million people watch the show when it's on each week on the Hallmark. It's the biggest hit on the Hallmark Channel. And frankly, it's the top-rated scripted show on Sunday nights when it's on.
Sunday's precious real estate. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's when you're going up against the big boys, so to speak.
Right.
Amazing.
You know, what I love about the Hardys is not just their loyalty to the show, but the way they built community with one another.
Right.
And, you know, because it harkens back to the way God created us and said, it's not good to be alone. You need to be in community, you know. And I love the way they celebrate together.
Yes.
And they've invited you guys, right, to join them at times?
We host an annual. We're not honestly right now going to be able to do it because of COVID this year. But we host an annual, you know, for lack of a better term, Hardy's Con, and we give them an experience with our cast. They get to have an engagement with our cast, and then we bust them out to our Hope Valley set, and they get to wander around and take pictures, and it's been a blessing. Patty helps me organize that each year. And we have a big volunteer team that we could never, ever have managed the Hardy's movement without an amazing volunteer team.
Speaking of community and your own, narrowing it down to your own little tribe with your five children and your three boys and your two girls, I'd love to hear about your beautiful girls. I know your sons are wonderful too, but I'm just going to ask you in particular, Patty, about your dear girls.
Well, we had three biological sons, as you know, and then we adopted our two daughters from Korea. Mm-hmm. Meredith is now 26 and she's in grad school. And then our youngest Mackenzie is 19. And we got Meredith at 4 months old from Korea, and we got Mackenzie at 8 months old from Korea. And Mackenzie has a lot of special needs. But as we're sitting here talking, I hear all kinds of noise above us.
She's up there cooking, baking bread right now.
Oh, okay. Yes.
I just think that's beautiful. And I know how that's impacted your family. We did not birth our two Chinese girls, but they came to us at 15 and 16 and lived in our home for 4 years as they went to the school that's just right outside of our little community. And you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Right.
And so we got to be host parents, and we're host mama, host papa. And they have just become daughters of the heart, mm-hmm. and have changed our lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I used to, when I only had my three children, two boys and a girl, and then, you know, my pilgrimage with cancer and how I was no longer able to have any more children. I think I cried more over being told I could have no more children than the fact that I had cancer, because I always wanted five. Uh-oh. So, Patty, I look at you and I think, oh. And so what did God do? My girls remind me all the time that God heard your prayer and he gave you your five.
Right. That's right. Yeah, it's such a blessing. I mean, people sometimes say, oh, you guys are such saints for adopting your two daughters. And I look at them like, what are you talking about? They're the blessing. We're not the blessing. They're the blessing to us. Because it's just opened our eyes to the world in such a bigger way. And you know, it's really, you know, we work in this film and TV business, and it's entertainment, and we're trying to do good things and send good messages. But honestly, what's real, love, you know, what's real is love. Love is what's real, right?
Yes.
Home is what's real. And I can remember coming home, you know, from the studio, and Patty would just hand me one of our children and say, I need a break.
I have my first on my shoulder and say, I'm out of here.
It's your turn. And, you know, honestly, that's what keeps us real as human beings and families, what keeps us real. And as parents, and you know, it's the best thing ever, because it's how we clone our faith and our values for future generations.
I've just wondered if you would happen to have, in this vast career that you have, any funny, you know, on set, production, off
when just everything went wrong.
Honestly, you know, all of the embarrassing moments for me happened before we were married. To be really honest,
the pleather jacket. Oh,
yeah, the pleather jacket.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
Because honestly, I was such a doofus back in the day that it was pretty lame. And then our oldest son, who you know,
I think he thinks we've always been embarrassing. I think he's still embarrassed of us.
You just open your mouth, Dad, and then you embarrass me. But honestly, you know, God has blessed us to the point where we haven't been in the tabloids or anything. And so that at least has been a good thing. But, you know, the world of sitcoms that you know, and, you know, I did that for about 10 years. You know, there's lots of laughter in our business.
Yes.
Some of it, you know, tears of laughter. Some of it tears of pain. But for the most part, God has been, you know, so faithful. And I kind of feel like I'm, you know, and we're sort of in the most blessed people in the world club, is we didn't earn it. We didn't deserve it, you know, but we're trying to earn it. And it's been, you know, it's been an amazing opportunity and an amazing experience. And I can't tell you, we have more projects out in front of us, more exciting projects out in front of us right now than I've ever had in my career.
That's saying a lot.
And part of it is because I think people are starved to death for the kind of programming that we like to do.
And I'm going to tell you a case for Christ. Remarkable. Well done. Well done. So many of your films,
I remember Heart of a Man. I remember when I saw that. In fact, I text you the second I was done with it. I text you, Brian, and I just said, I am so proud that a film of this magnitude, I'll say, and depth came out of the Christian community.
Yeah.
It was such a well-done documentary.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm very proud of all those titles. And The Heart of Man has gone everywhere. It's gone all over the world now.
Yes, and I believe
it's tough subject matter when you see it. The nature of brokenness and the nature of the prodigal son story is what it's all about.
Yeah.
But I'm very proud of that. And I made it with some really talented young men.
Yes.
And we're actually working on our next one right now. We're very excited about that one too. It's going to be in the same level of production value that you loved about The Heart of Man.
Yeah.
Dan.
Excellent.
So, yeah. I'm really excited about that one.
So Patty, I wanted to ask you, what advice would you give, young couple just starting out, let's say, you know, who's married to someone working in the industry, what would you say to them that's been something you felt that Brian needed or every husband needs?
I would just say you have to be intentional. And then once you have children, that's tricky too. You know, our children, pretty much October through December, when we would go out, we would tell them we were Christmas shopping. So they need to be really good for the babysitter. That's movie.
Yeah, we would say Christmas shopping just in order to go spend to have a date night.
Sure, right? Sure.
And they're like, okay, we'll be good.
We'll be good.
Yeah.
Awesome. I would just add to that, guys, and you guys know this as well as we do. You have to choose love. Mm-hmm. Love's not a feeling. It can be a feeling, but that's fleeting, right? Love is a choice. Marriage is a covenant. It's a commitment you make. And you have to be intentional about renewing that commitment on a daily basis, because it's not going to all be happy. It's not all going to be, you know, when we went through our crisis, it was really stressful for us. And, you know, but you choose love. You choose to stay committed to that person. And in our business, it's rare for anybody to have, you know, a marriage as long as you guys do, or as long as we've had. We're coming up on 40 years of marriage in December, right?
Awesome. Yeah.
Awesome.
We don't know that many people in our business who can say that. Yeah. We're not gloating about it. We're not lording it over anybody. We're thankful. We're grateful that God has allowed us to be able to say that. And it's an important thing for young people getting into the business. Get married to somebody who has the same heartbeat as you, who has the same sense of faith and commitment to God that you do, because it's the only thing that will get you through the hardships.
Yes.
It's a hard business. It's a exciting business. But it's a hard business. And the only thing that will get you through is a loving spouse who's committed to helping you be the best person you can be, and vice versa.
Amen.
And you two exemplify that so well. I mean, going back to the very beginning of our conversation, Patty, time and time again, you were referenced of how you championed, or you introduced it, Brian, to someone, or how you just encouraged him. And that's what we do as helpmeats. We encourage each other in life. You know, it doesn't matter what career you're working in, just in our faith and in our life and in our family. Mm-hmm. Well, we sure appreciate you guys being with us. We appreciate what you've done with the talents God has given you. You've put good out on our screens across the world. And that's no small thing. That's a critically important thing. And it's a great kingdom value. But we also just love who you guys are.
Yes.
As a married couple, as friends, as fellow Christians. We just appreciate you guys.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. The best. Love you guys.
Hope to see you soon.
Thank you for joining us for Life Off Screen with Dan and Peggy Ruppel. Life Off Screen is produced by Master Media International. Our technical director is Jason Rugg. Please subscribe to the Life Off Screen YouTube channel, or subscribe to the Life Off Screen podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. You can leave your comments in the comment section. And to find out more about Master Media, go to mastermedia.com. Thanks again for joining us. Hope to see you next time.